Alan Greenspan, painted a grim picture and predicted that significant layoffs will prompt rising unemployment. For his part, Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez says there are signs the economy is recovering.
The commercial paper rate that companies are paying to get overnight loans or get three-month loans has also dropped.
Hard times are continuing in the auto industry. Chrysler says it's cutting more than 1,800 factory jobs. It looks like Michael Bloomberg will be allowed to run for a third term as mayor of New York City. The city council decided to extend the city's two-term limit, allowing Bloomberg to possibly lead the city for four more years. Fire officials say a wildfire burned 100 acres of brush and grass near the Getty Art Museum in Los Angeles before it was doused early today. No injuries are reported. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Melissa Rayberger, NBC News Radio.
$10? Maybe two cups of gourmet coffee.
Oh, about 3 gallons of gas?
These days, $10 doesn't go very far. Except, that is, at Sam's Club. This weekend, for just $10, you can get a Sam's Club membership that's good through December 31st, 2008. Enjoy members-only pricing on the things you need every day. Milk, produce, laundry detergent, diapers, pet care, and more. 10 weeks of savings for just $10. Just when you need it most.
Heard they got great prices on gas, too.
10 weeks, $10. Starting this Friday, only at Sam's Club.
Why does this cough make me feel like my lungs are going to come out of my chest?
Robitussin knows one of the ways your body clears itself of mucus is by coughing. That's why Robitussin DM Max is formulated with a double dose of the medicine that helps your body clear away mucus compared to Robitussin DM, and it helps control your cough. Robitussin knows the relief you need. Robitussin DM Max. Double the strength against mucus for a reason. Use as directed.
Welcome to Isla Earth. Who's more environmentally responsible? Seniors? Young adults? Men? Women? Actually, when it comes to recycling glass at least, a recent study conducted by researchers at the University of Granada observed that housewives are more likely to do it than university students. So, why do they recycle glass? In this study, the housewives recycled because they made it a personal rule to recycle. It was a behavior based on an ethical or moral obligation. True, recycling glass isn't as convenient for students who spend much of the day away from where they live. But with academic training, wouldn't ecological awareness increase? Apparently not. Educational programs designed to raise environmental consciousness seem to have had no influence on the students' glass recycling behavior. So, while increasing environmental awareness among young people seems important, this study suggests it simply isn't enough. Environmentally responsible behaviors like recycling glass, paper, and other products isn't just something to learn about. Housewives in the study seem to have internalized that it's something we should practice daily because it's the right thing to do. Learn more about this study and get tips on recycling for kids and adults at islaearth.org. Isla Earth is produced by the Catalina Island Conservancy with support from its Fund for a Sustainable Planet, because Earth is an island.
Good evening, gals and ghouls. It's that time of the year again, and the spooktacular owners and employees of Digital Electronic Services Incorporated in Riverside are taking this opportunity to remind parents that safety should always come first when celebrating Halloween. This message is courtesy of Digital Electronic Services Incorporated in Riverside, serving the community for 21 years, experts in telemetry and SCADA systems installation. Have a happy Halloween.
The wow factor is what I discovered at Inland Body and Paint Center in Fontana. They specialize in commercial truck and trailer body repair, as well as the highest quality paint work in the Inland Empire. When you need your truck to look showroom new again, call Frank at Inland Body and Paint Center. Call 909-434-0466. 909-434-0466. They work with all insurance claims, and Inland Body and Paint Center does the job right the first time. 909-434-0466.
Now you can see what you're hearing. Look in on KCAA-TV at www.kcaaradio.com. The station that leaves no listener behind. AM 1050, KCAA.
On the wind, I feel a warm, like the time where I was born. Just like
the Midnight Bookworm, Vin Smith. Three shows in one, live, back-to-back, right here on KCAA Radio, the station that leaves no listener behind. And the first hour, we have Goddess Radio. At 8 o'clock, we have a really incredible show on Midnight Bookworm, Books and Entertainment. And we are preempting the 9 o'clock program, Beyond the Paranormal, to continue on 90 minutes with an extremely surprise guest that comes on at 8:30. But I will tell you, at 8 o'clock, Lee Rubin comes on, the syndicated cartoonist. The cartoonist who does Rubes. That's at 8 o'clock. Lee will stay on to help Bruce Marin, co-host of Midnight Books and Entertainment. And we will be interviewing this surprise guest, Bruce Marin, and Lee, Rubin, and me. But right now, it's Goddess Radio, and I want to welcome in my co-host, the always lovely, the always intelligent and sparkling, Penny Way. Good evening, Penny. How you doing? Hello, Penny. Okay,
hello.
There you are. Okay,
hello.
How you
glad
doing,
to be here
kid?
Again.
Hey, great to have you. And tell me real fast before we bring our guest on, tell me real fast what you've been up to this week in your profession as one of America's great help people. You help people in so many ways, as an empowerment coach, as a motivational speaker, soon to be a published author. Wow. Blows me away, Penny Way. Tell me what you've been up to this week.
My usual hypnotizing people in my office.
Uh-huh.
Well, one of my favorite things to do. But I actually covering for the AFI Film Festival, which is it's coming up on October 30th through November 8th, November 7th
wow.
and 8th. So it's going to be chock full of really amazing screenings of films that you want to see, independent and some that are mainstream. And there's been a couple really great ones that I've touched upon this week. So I'm in knee deep in the screening room in the darkness, you know, watching these films and covering it. Also for my radio show on Wednesdays here at KCAA 1050.
Ah, hey, you're going to bring us an actress, right? A famous actress for the show very soon. Is that not correct?
Well, you know, I'll be bringing some people for Goddess Radio. Of course, they all have mm-hmm. to be ladies, but there have been some interesting filmmakers.
Ladies, yeah.
Yeah, interesting filmmakers I've met this week, and some authors, and so I will be touching base with you to bring them on the show in the near future.
Oh, what a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
That is terrific.
Yeah,
so we're starting
to
get into ice skating season now as the weather turns. who do you think is going to emerge as the next big ice skating? Ladies, of course. We're not interested in the fun.
Well, who's your favorite?
On Goddess Radio.
Who's your favorite?
I'm not sure about who the latest phenoms are, but if you go back over a long period of time, I have to go with Peggy Fleming. You know what I'm saying? Her mother made her a beautiful dress out of curtains, I think. And
wow.
It just touched my heart. It's such an expensive sport for families, especially in the old days when Avery Brundage was head of the International Olympic Committee. And everything had to be so amateur that you couldn't even have sponsors. I don't know how anybody afforded that.
Yeah, making a dress out of curtains sounds like Sound of Music, you know, when they made the play clothes out of
does.
The curtains.
It does, yeah.
But you got to
yeah.
do what you got to do to make it happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's an expensive sport, as you said. It's very
it
true.
Is.
And, I mean, if you've got fabric, you can make anything out of that, you know, curtains, anything. You know, ice skating clothes don't take
Queen
a lot
Elizabeth.
Of fabric.
I understand Queen Elizabeth had an outfit sewn from fabric she'd had in the castle. For years, decades maybe. So, yeah, I think that that's a... To me, it's always been a touching story. I felt that Peggy Fleming personified as well as anyone a family getting together and helping your child achieve this kind of greatness. You have a similar story in a way, in that your family backed you in ice skating and kept you on that straight and narrow. And I think that alone has given you what it takes to help people in a terrific kind of a way. Once again, give our audience, I'd like to do this every week so people have a chance to touch base with you. Give our audience your contact information, your show, of course, and your websites.
Well, I'm so honored that I'm part of the KCAA 1050 AM radio family, along with you. So my show, Positive Changes with Penny Way, airs Wednesdays at 6 p.m. here, Pacific Standard Time. You can check out the podcast as well if you can't listen to it live. And if people want more information on me, they can go to my website, which is www.pannyway.com, and it's spelled PannyWei.com.
Do you like to be scared out of your wits? You know, we're heading for Halloween.
I know. I hate it, actually. I am not a big fan of horror movies.
Okay.
There's enough to be scared about in life in general. I don't need the extra spooking voluntarily. So.
Well, we have a lady that has not exactly written what you'd call a spooky story, but she has written a story with atmosphere that is misty and reminiscent of her native San Francisco, and it takes place way back when, in the Roman Empire, the winter of 836 AUC, which is actually 83 AD. The weather is cold. It's bitter. It can be frightening to put yourself in those shoes, and Kelly Stanley did just that. The book is Nocte Dormienda, A Long Night for Sleeping, an Arcturus Mystery. Kelly Stanley, welcome to Goddess Radio.
Thank you so much, Vin and Panay. This is a complete privilege and honor to be here on Goddess Radio and KCAA with you two. Thanks for having me.
Hey, we're glad to have you with us. And tell Panay what your book is about and why you chose to go back and write a mystery so far back into history.
Oh, sure, I'd love to. Well, I want to assure Panay that it's not a horror book. It's what I call Roman noir. And the reason for it is my first book. It's a debut novel. It's the first novel I've ever actually attempted to write, so I was very lucky to get it published and very happy about doing so, obviously. But the reason I wrote it is because my background is actually as a master's degree student in classics, and I graduated with a master's from San Francisco State University. And while I was in class, actually doing something as seemingly boring as translating a passage of Tacitus, who is a famous Latin and Roman historian, it struck me that there was something in here that needed to be told. And I've been inspired from other successful authors like Stephen Saylor and Lindsay Davis, and there are actually more people who write about Roman Britain and the Roman Empire in England than there are in America, but Stephen Saylor and Lindsay Davis are the most well-known of American authors, or published in America, I should say, because Lindsay's actually British. And I thought, you know, I'd really like to do this. Plus, I have a lot of student debt. And it seemed to me that it would be a nice way to try to do something really creative, something that has been inside of me to do for a very, very long time, even though I really wasn't aware of it until that moment. And, you know, I thought I could teach, I could go on for my PhD, and that was a possibility, or I could sort of do what Julius Caesar did and roll the die. And I did, and I wrote the book, and it was published. And again, it's set in Roman Britain in 83, as you so eloquently described then. But the tone of the book and the style is actually inspired from somebody more closer to you guys, in that it was very much inspired by Raymond Chandler, who is my favorite noir writer.
Incredible writer, yeah.
Yeah,
died in 1959. And that he passed away actually with an unfinished novel, and the great Robert B. Parker finished that up.
Absolutely, Perchance to Dream.
Perchance to Dream, and it was just a lovely tribute to Bob Parker. By all accounts, we have some mutual friends. I don't know him personally, but we'll have to change that eventually. He is so welcoming for young writers. He's just a tremendous gentleman. And, of course, Raymond Chandler probably was the best in the business. Okay, I know somebody's out there saying, oh, no, Vin! No. Dashiell Hammett. I'll argue with you all day about that, Vin. It's Dashiell Hammett. Well, I get in these kind of literary arguments with people all the time. Penny Way, who's your favorite noir writer? And don't tell me you don't like a good dark mystery.
No. Of course I love good dark mysteries.
What's your favorite,
I think,
Penny?
Books are different than movies. Movies, to me, you know, movies are environmental hypnosis, and if the director does a good job, he makes you experience and think and feel exactly those emotions that he's putting on the screen through the characters. And so, for me, it's a lot more manipulative if you're watching a movie, and that's why it's kind of, it really is scary. But books I enjoy, because, you know, you're using your head, and you're getting into your head, and you're becoming the characters, and it's a little different experience. So, reading and writing is not a big deal. It's fine with me. I'm okay.
You know, it's funny that you say that, Penny, because Chandler was also such a great screenwriter, and actually as much influenced by screenplays and film noir, particularly because we have a great film noir festival in San Francisco, and it's also in L.A., Noir City, that's hosted by the terrific czar of noir, Eddie Muller. And that show, that festival just is par excellence for seeing some of these films that you just don't get to see even on TCM. And what I was saying is Raymond Chandler wrote Double Indemnity. He wrote Strangers on a Train. He wrote The Blue Dahlia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was an equal master of the screenplay as he was of the novel. And he's just, I agree with you, Vin. I love Hammett, but, you know, for my money, it's always been Chandler.
Yeah, I think that is not only true, but what you get is a novel from Chandler that is both literary and cinematic. Very cinematic, very literary, both. It's a great blend of both. That takes a lot of doing. Only a handful of authors have ever actually mastered that. F. Scott Fitzgerald was one. And, to base your own inner self and that muse that the writer has to reach for, to base that on somebody with a pedigree of the great Raymond Chandler. I think his character, Philip Marlowe, is by far the best of the Gumshoes. What do you think, Penny? You've seen some of these, read some of these books, seen some of the movies. What do you think about Philip Marlowe as a character? And remember, the greatest actor of film noir in history, Humphrey Bogart, did a perfect rendition of Philip Marlowe.
Philip Marlowe. He's a fictional character.
Oh, yeah.
When I watch these things, I'm like, I think it's, I love the style, and, you know, his character is foremost within the genre of the hard-boiled crime fiction, right? Originated in the 1920s, something like that. Way back then. Black
Kelly,
Mask. Yeah, sorry?
Kelly, the critics are just kind of wondering how you did this. How did you across a style that brings history accurately to life and yet makes the book very, very accessible? How did you do that? What's the process?
Well, it was really the ignorance of never having been published before and never having a track record and really not knowing anything about the industry. I guess you can say I didn't know any better than to try. And, you know, I knew I wanted to write a mystery set at this particular point. I knew I was inspired from an incident in Tacitus. And I knew I had this deep and abiding love for the period from the 20s to the 50s in American culture and history. And I love, love, love the style of noir from, you know, which B-movies of the period, you know, it wasn't called noir, as you know, until the French critics got to it in the 60s.
That's true.
And really, the epiphany happened at a Noir City Film Festival. And that's when I just sort of sat there, and I think I was watching, I don't know, Sudden Fear, maybe, with Joan Crawford, another great film. And it just struck me, you know, I want to make history real for people. I want it to seem as visceral and as important and as immediate as the news that they're listening to on KCAA or tuning into on TV. I want them to realize that it's not something that you can just lock away and put and have dust on it and doesn't matter, because people were people, and the same problems have a tendency to repeat themselves, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So the medium that I chose to do that with was noir, because to me, noir is immediate. It takes some of the important elements of crime fiction, the serious elements, and it doesn't try to sweeten them. It doesn't try to sugarcoat them. It embraces them. It shows you corruption. It shows you desperation. It shows you good people who are flawed good people, like Marlowe, trying to do the right thing in a very, very, very imperfect world. You don't necessarily always trust your client when you're a private eye. You don't always necessarily trust the police, especially in 1930s Santa Monica, as any reader of Chandler knows. Or I should call it Bay City. So that was really the epiphany, Vin. You know, it was Eddie's film festival. And I'm a passport holder there. I go see everything that I can every year when it comes around in January, because it's just a continuous source of inspiration to me. That, and of course, you know, being a Chandler aficionado for a long time, and I just said, why not? I'll give it a try. I'll call it Roman Noir, and we'll see if it works.
Boy, does that resonate with me. About the first time that we get a chance to do the Midnight Bookworm on the road shows, I'm going to have to go to a noir festival. I've covered the Steinbeck Festival for several years back, for a couple of years in a row. In fact, this programming note, next week at 8 o'clock on the Midnight Bookworm Books and Entertainment, we have Rick Wartzman coming on. He's written a book that's going to shoot to the top of the nonfiction bestsellers, and it's called Obscene in the Extreme, and it's about the book burning of Grapes of Wrath in 1939, the John Steinbeck masterpiece. Rick Wartzman's coming on next week on the 8 o'clock Midnight Bookworm Books and Entertainment. So what we have here as writers, we're real lucky here to have three writers.
I know, we're all writers.
Talking to our audience. And, hey, we get inspired by what we read. If you don't... I had a guy on this show. I won't mention his name because he's a very, very good friend of mine. And maybe listeners will remember, he never reads. He's almost never read a book. He writes books, and the books he writes are good, but he almost never reads. That has got to be an anomaly. I mean, that doesn't usually happen. What do you think, Kelly Stanley? Can you be a great writer and not be much of a reader?
I don't think you can be. I mean, you can be. You have to obviously be an observer of life, which I suppose would be the counterargument. And you have to have empathy for people. I'm convinced of that. You have to understand them, like Panny does. You have to have a motive. You have to be a motivator. You have to get into their psychologies and really be able to, you know, communicate what you see and what you feel. But you also, just in terms of craft, you have to read. I mean, I started reading mythology when I was 7 years old. My first mystery, like many other people, was Nancy Drew. Talk about goddess radio. Nancy, Nancy is a goddess.
Yeah.
You know, and I
love Nancy Drew mysteries.
I love
Hardy Boys, you know. They were terrific.
I love Hardy Boys. Yeah.
Exactly. that's how a lot of people get their start.
They were all published by the same syndicate, the Stratemeyer Syndicate, and the writer of the Nancy Drew books was the same writer who wrote, get this, Hardy Boys. So the fellow who, or perhaps even gal, they did have ladies in the Stratemeyer Syndicate that did some of the contract writing. But the fellow or fellows who call themselves Franklin W. Dixon, there's your Hardy Boy author, same person as whoever called themselves Carolyn Keene, who wrote Nancy Drew. So, and they're fantastic, because if you get a savvy teacher and you ask that teacher, how do you teach people to read? They'll tell you the same thing that my piano teacher told me on the phone a week ago. I am reunited with my 95-year-old piano teacher, Catherine Crone-Miller, Crone-Miller School of Music in Whittier. She's now in an assisted living home, and she's bright and she's cheery. And I just sent her one of my CDs. She said, Vin, I try to figure each child out and what they liked, the kind of music that they liked. And I would find that kind of music, and I would tailor-make all of my teaching to the individual student. Is that what you find with your teachers? Let's ask both of our ladies tonight. Let's ask my co-host, Pani Way, and then go to our guest, Kelly Stanley. Did you have teachers who did this kind of tailoring, this custom-made teaching, Pani?
Actually, I think what your piano teacher did was quite awesome, because each child is so very different and everybody gravitates to something different. And you know how I always talk about following your heart and what makes you feel happy, and then you'll start opening up the doors to abundance. And in my childhood, actually, my piano and piano teaching, and I actually played the flute as well, I was classically trained. And so my teachers actually thought a good foundation started with classical training. So we didn't even venture far from that into, like, maybe jazz piano, which is what I would want to have played, or even the guitar. So I just sort of, you know, when you're a kid, you just do what you're told and you follow what the adults say, and you hope to get a mentor or a teacher who is more enlightened, that they have the awareness to cater things to each child so that you can see how the child can blossom and push them in that direction, or mold them in that direction, or encourage them to go play things that make them happy. So, I enjoy classical music, but I would have wanted to play something else.
Kelly Stanley, same question. Did you have teachers who customized and tailor-made their instruction to you to help mold you into the novelist that you are today?
I would say yes, and I would also qualify my response by saying that my first teachers would have been my parents. And I think that that's a very, it's extremely important, really, piece of the equation. When you have parents that teach and instill their children, and I'm an only child, but, you know, that teach you to believe in yourself and to believe that you can do anything, that you can be anything, it opens up a world for you to try things that you may not have tried, and find that you do like some things that you may not have thought that you liked. So I would say that my parents were the people who really taught me that first. But I still have extremely fond memories of a lady in Quincy, Florida, when we lived there very briefly in my second grade year, because my parents traveled a bit when I was young. At a pretty poor school that was predominantly African American. And she took me into the library, and she put in my hands The Ghost of Blackwood Hall, my first Nancy Drew. And it's because she bothered to ask me, what do you like to read? Mm-hmm. And I said, I like ghost stories, you know. I like fun things, kind of adventurous things. And she saw that I was interested, and she's the one who started it.
Wow. We've got a whole half hour left on Goddess Radio. This is the Midnight Bookworm, Vin Smith. at 8 o'clock on Midnight Bookworm, Books and Entertainment. We've got syndicated cartoonist Lee Rubin. At 8:30, a top secret guest. So secret, the guest will be using a voice alterator. What a night. On the Midnight Bookworm, Vin Smith, three shows in one. KCAA Radio, the station that leaves no listener behind. Back in moments.
There are fears that I can't face, and I'm afraid that I might sink again. Then I feel your love.
When we get old, will you take care of me if I can't get around anymore?
Of course. We'll find a way. Are you going to take care of me if I can't see anymore?
I'll read to you every day.
And if one of us gets Alzheimer's disease, what then?
Call 1-800-437-2423 for a free booklet on caring for your loved ones from Alzheimer's Disease Research. 1-800-437-2423.
It's all about the green during the month of October right here at Saboba Casino. Saboba encourages you to go green by giving you the chance to win a brand new Lexus SUV hybrid and $100,000 in cash prizes. The Lexus SUV hybrid is the hottest crossover vehicle on the road today, and Saboba is giving away two SUVs, one on Saturday, October 11th, and another on Saturday, October 25th, plus $10,000 in cash each day. There's two ways to win. Use your club Saboba card and play your favorite slot machine anywhere in the casino or with Saboba's new Total Promo. This state-of-the-art electronic drawing drum allows players to enter all of Saboba's promotions just by swiping their Club Saboba card, no wait. Just enjoy your favorite game, swipe your card, and be automatically entered in the promotions of your choice. It's that easy. And don't miss Saboba's $10,000 a day cash Tuesdays and Thursdays for the entire month of October. Saboba Casino, where winning is just the beginning.
Announcing 6 months at half off the regular price for your new storage unit at East Street Self Storage in San Bernardino. That's right, for a limited time, get half off your new storage unit for a full 6 months only at East Street Self Storage, located at 1723 South East Street, just south of Orange Show Road. But wait, there's more. East Street Self Storage now offers e-waste removal. That's right. Looking to get rid of old TVs, monitors, or appliances? Give East Street Self Storage a call today. Looking for a moving truck? East Street Self Storage has that too. Open 7 days a week, East Street Self Storage features coded gate access, 24-hour video surveillance, climate control units, and document shredding service. Call manager Dave Davis today at 909-888-8208. Ask Dave about half off your new storage unit, e-waste removal, and move-in truck today. Make sure you mention KCAA 1050 AM, and Dave will give you a free gift. Call 909-888-8208. That's 909-888-8208. That's East Street Self Storage, your new home for e-waste and moving truck.
Save time. Save gas at Toyota of San Bernardino. Toyota of San Bernardino has 8 Toyota models that get over 25 miles per gallon on the highway.
Garmin, Corolla,
Matrix, Camry,
Solara, Avalon,
RAV4, Prius.
Reserve your hybrid now. Plan for the future. Save time, save gas at Toyota of San Bernardino. Used hybrids are also available. Log on to www.toyotasb.com. Shop online, then come on down to Toyota of San Bernardino. Just off the 215 freeway at the Auto Plaza exit in the San Bernardino Auto Mall. Call 877-5-GOT-MPG. Check out all the Toyota models getting better than 25 miles per gallon on the highway, like
Garmin, Corolla,
Matrix, Camry,
Solara.
Save time, save gas at Toyota of San Bernardino. Log on to www.toyotasb.com or call 877-5-GOT-MPG. That's 877-5-GOT-MPG.
Everybody's talking about changes nowadays.
Our time for change has come.
I'm here to tell you that all changes are good, but positive changes are even better. So tune in to Positive Changes with me, Tanny Way, every Wednesday at 6 p.m. on KCAA 1050 AM, the station that leaves no listener behind.
Make sure you put that on your to-do list. Positive Changes with Tanny Way. She'll be your number one boost for the day, Wednesdays at 6 p.m.
Don't miss a minute of the action. Check out the podcasts at www.kcaaradio.com. The station that leaves no listener behind, AM 1050 KCAA.
And we're back. The Midnight Bookworm, Vin Smith. We're in the first hour, which is always Goddess Radio. Our goddess chanteuse, the absolutely incredible sounds of Joan Jett's Crimson and Clover. And we opened up with Charity Angel giving us our goddess chanteuse, our first two cuts of the night. Beautiful songs by great lady singers. And we play that through all 3 hours. Okay, this program note, at 8 o'clock we have cartoonist Lee Rubin comes on to be interviewed by myself, the Midnight Bookworm, Vin Smith, and co-host Bruce Merrin. And we're going to have at 8:30 a secret guest, so secret that he comes to you with a voice alterator. Because were his identity to be known? Not good. We're going to be talking about something extremely important, and I think I'm going to have to have you wait around until the top of the hour when we move on to Midnight Bookworm, Books and Entertainment, to tell you what the subject is about. It's that important and that secret. And this additional program note, next week we have Rick Wartzman, as I think I mentioned a little bit earlier, coming on with his book, Obscene to the Extreme, about the burning of John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. We also have on Beyond the Paranormal, Anne Andrews, who's the most famous abductee in the history of ufology. And we have Regan, the fantastic investigator from APART up in Washington State, and she's going to come on to help us interview Anne Andrews, who comes to us live from the UK. That's next week. And also, my great good friend Glenda Burgess has written a marvelous book called The Geography of Love, and she's coming on next week on Goddess Radio. So we have got some tremendous guests scheduled all along. We got a great one here tonight with us, Kelly Stanley. The book is Nox Dormienda, A Long Night for Sleeping, an Arcturus Mystery. So now we should go to the lead character in the story, Arcturus, and find out what this guy is all about. Kelly Stanley, tell us about Arcturus, your viewpoint character.
Well, As I said, it's really inspired from Chandler, so I wanted to write the book in the first person. And I wanted to deal with somebody who is an outsider, who has a mentality similar to that of a PI, of a classic PI character like Marlowe. So Arcturus is your sort of, he's your torn apart man. He has a foot in both the Roman world and a foot in the native occupied world, because his mother was a native Celt and his father was a Roman. Plus, he's got the mindset of a healer. And as Penny, I'm sure, can tell you, people who have the power to help other people in such concrete ways, like psychologists or doctors, it also comes with a big sense of responsibility. It comes with a big sense of potential guilt if you can't help them, which also leads to psychological conflict. So Arcturus is a man who is not at home really anywhere, except within his own code, very similar to Marlowe. And Nox Dormienda is actually named Nox Dormienda because I like to say it's Latin for the big sleep. It's the same metaphor. In this book, you know, he's
clever.
He sort of finds his way closer to figuring out who he is a little bit more than when the book starts. But you know, I'm hoping that it continues for a long time, and life's a journey. So I'd be happy to take the mean streets with Arcturus any day.
Now, you're both somewhat familiar with San Francisco. Is that not correct? Panny, don't you have some experience around San Francisco in the course of your lifetime? I know you're an L.A. girl, but you do know San Francisco pretty well, right?
Yeah, I have family over there. It's one of my favorite cities in the entire United States. It's got a very special feel when you walk the streets there. And everything's really accessible.
San Francisco's awesome. I hope
It's so great for artists too, and there's so much history there, you know, with writers as well, like, you know.
How does this inform your work, Kelly? And how does it inform your work, Panny? You must have taken you got this huge heart, Panny Way. You must have taken some of this sensitivity that you have to people's problems from your experiences in San Francisco. And I can tell by reading Nox Dormienda that San Francisco is deeply ingrained in Kelly Stanley. That's why she is a live wire with a real understanding of human nature. I think that's what it is. You have to understand the human condition to work at what you ladies work at. Let's start with Kelly and then go to Panny and tell us how San Francisco has informed the work that you do.
Well, it's funny that you mention it, Vin, because it's right now I feel like I've been living in 1940 San Francisco for the last year, because I just finished my third book, which is a new series and a very, very dark novel set in 1940 San Francisco with a female PI as a protagonist. And it concerns really racial tensions between the Chinese-American and Japanese-American communities in the wake of Nanking. So it's an extremely dark book dealing with some very, very, very bleak and horrific periods of history. It's not a sugar-coated look at 1940, although, you know, I love Glenn Miller as much as anyone else. So San Francisco, yes, it is in my heart, not to make a pun on Tony Bennett, but it is someplace that I feel is constantly inspirational and constantly changing, and yet has a core that remains the same as when it was a sprawling, no-holds-barred Barbary Coast, area.
Must have been a rough town back then.
Yeah, I
the Barbary Coast days. Panny, what is your impression of what San Francisco has done to inform the work that you do?
Well, I like San Francisco because I'm a big fan of, you know, the works of our poets, you know, the beat poets and people like Lenny Bruce, you know, who was an American comedian and writer and social critic and satirist of the 1950s and 60s. And they used to hang out at certain, like, cafes and coffee shops in San Francisco. And when I was in my 20s, I'd go and try to find every place that they were hanging out and see if I could pick up the vibe. So it was one of those places where, you know, it's just such a diverse place to live, and so much inspiration there that you can draw from just the environment and the people and observing people. So much like Kelly was saying earlier, to be a good writer, you have to be an observer of human nature, and you get a lot of characters and inspiration to create characters by watching people as well. And San Francisco is one of those places that can lend to that, I believe. And it's so close also to, you know, nature, like, you know, places where you can hang out in nature, like Big Sur and everything, so you can get away from the city if you want to and go to other places where, like, Henry Miller and Anais Nin used to hang out in Big Sur. You know, there's just such a big history with authors coming from that area. So I love the city. I did that I did that whole adventure of trying to find all the coffee shops, like, you know, way early on, because it's being a writer is in my blood, and I gotta, you know, you take inspiration from those who've already been successful before you. So
I wonder. I get this feeling that my thoughts that somebody should do an updated Jack the Ripper, and yet make Jack the Ripper some kind of immortal character. He was never caught in London, never. And bring him down through the ages, and you'd set him down in a city like New Orleans or a city like San Francisco. You wouldn't put him in Dallas. Why do so few great works of art come out of Dallas compared to some of these other places?
Well, you know, Vin, I think it was Richard Matheson that wrote Wolf in the Fold, which was a Star Trek episode, original series, that dealt with an eternal spirit of evil that wound up being essentially Jack the Ripper. You remember? It was an episode that
That's really where I got that feeling. Yeah, it hit me. I said, somebody needs to update this story. Then another voice said, Vinny! It's been done! So I think there was a time I would sit back in the afternoons. I had my whole schedule set up around this. I had all my sales calls. Somebody said, can you meet me at 3 o'clock? No, I'm busy at 3, but 4:30 will work. And I would sit there watching old Star Trek episodes. And this was 10 years after the show was stupidly laid to rest, and if we happen to have any executives who were in the decision to cancel Star Trek, the television show, you, sir, are a doom conf. But anyway, I had to have seen that episode, but it just seems to me that this is a city that a novelist like Kelly Stanley ought to be setting a lot of books there.
Well, I certainly hope to be. You know, I'm sort of torn between these two worlds, 183 AD, 1940 AD, and the immediate years thereof. I'd also like to do a contemporary novel eventually set in Humboldt County, because actually I spent my high school years in the Redwood country near Eureka.
Hey.
Yeah.
I love Humboldt State University.
Oh, yeah. Humboldt State's terrific.
I love Arcata. Great town.
Arcata's terrific.
Yeah,
Ferndale
one of the best.
Is a nice place to visit. You know, the Victorian village. It's actually. So there. It's sort of the forgotten parts of California, and my parents live up there. So, you know, I'm sort of tossing these ideas around. It's when you're just getting started, you've got a lot of choices to make, and sort of continuing your career depends on which choices you decide to follow. So I'm hoping that the 1940 books do well. I'm hoping to see Arcturus get picked up and continue on. So
I want to see a movie. I want to see a movie.
Oh, well, thank you. From your mouth to Hollywood's ears.
Yeah.
What would you recommend for aspiring writers, for those who are listening, especially young women listening, who can get some more empowerment and inspiration from another goddess like yourself, like in terms of how to get started if they want to become an author and how do they get published?
Well, I actually just gave a talk on this very subject
this
weekend. To Great. Sisters in Crime in Sacramento. And Sisters in Crime, if you're interested in writing mysteries or crime-related novels, thrillers, is a very good place to start. And they're not just about women, but they were founded specifically to help settle some of the inequities in the industry that tend to favor men. For example, male authors tend to get reviewed more often than female writers. And this was a group founded in the 70s, and you can join it whether you're published or not. They have a lot of very inspirational people in it. It's a really good place to start. Joining groups like Sisters in Crime is extremely important to giving yourself camaraderie, giving yourself connections. They actually have a program there for people who are writing but haven't been published yet. And then the second thing is you just have to keep going. And that means turning off the phone. It means asking your family to step up and take what you're doing seriously. It means devoting a certain amount of time every day, preferably, because it's very hard to start up once you've stopped. Put aside a certain amount of time every day to that commitment. And, you know, just having like a word count goal per week is a good approach. I wouldn't do it per day because something could come up. But if you say, I'm going to write 3 pages a week, it'll add up as long as you do it consistently. And the more you do it, the easier it gets. The easier it gets to make time to do it. So I would say those two things are places to start. And really, it's your perseverance and your determination and the family support that you have that really helps you finish the book, which is the most important thing of all.
Right. And then you have a beautiful product to be very proud of once you take those little baby steps, like you said, just every day just showing up to the page somehow.
Exactly. I mean, when you're coaching people, I mean, is your approach to tell them to take a big change or is it to take incremental changes? Because I'm interested in that because having just had to talk about motivation as Sisters in Crime in Sacramento, I'm kind of curious to hear what you would say, Pani.
It would be the same thing. I think people tend to be self-sabotaging in nature sometimes, and we get really overwhelmed by big things, like big projects. And even like when I was a figure skater, Vin knows a little bit about the story, like, you know, you want to get to the Olympics, the gold medal, but that seems so far in the distance. Like getting a book published seems so far in the distance, but you have to whittle it down and break it down to baby steps so that each day when you accomplish something, even like you're saying, like a few words on the page or 3 pages a week, you can start building that self-confidence. And that self-esteem and self-confidence can go a long way to keep you motivated to reaching your goals. And it has to do exactly what you're saying, you know, to keep going. And the support system is really important, too. I find that some people don't usually have that. And that's the part that's, when they come into my office, if I have people with writer's block and or aspiring writers who can't get their job or their work done, it's because they're influenced by their environment or they're suggestible to the opinions of other people.
Well, you know, one thing you can avoid if that's the case, and I would say this for an aspiring writer, is to don't go to a critique group right off the bat, because a critique group is a very subjective thing. And if there's somebody in that critique group that doesn't know how to critique, they can set you back, you know, years from achieving your goal without
intending
to do it. Exactly.
You get traumatized. That's very wise advice.
I've long told aspiring writers to stay away from critique groups because what you want to do is find your voice within yourself, create the best possible product that you can, and then get professional help, absolutely professional help. You may even want to go out to a professional editor and pay their fees, which are usually reasonable when you think about it. That could be one step. Another step could be to say, you know, I think this is actually pretty good. I'm going to send it out, and always send it out in whatever form the agent, as an example, would require. But to go and join a writer's club, you're getting absolute amateurs looking at your stuff. It would be like getting 10 people off the street to critique an operation you're having in the hospital. I don't want to do it.
No, absolutely not.
I
didn't do the critique group thing because I, for the exact same reasons that you're mentioning, Vin, it was just, and to me, I needed to know that I could do it and I had to do it by myself. It was something I had to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. And they vary widely. I have a lot of friends who have published more books than I do who still use critique groups, but those are very highly selected critique groups of other authors who have more, you know, have a lot of experience in editing and publishing. But you can't subject yourself to that kind of potential for being disheartened, because it takes too much energy and too much time and too much courage to make decisions every day when you're writing, you know, what word to use, when to end a chapter, when to end a sentence. All of those things are decisions you're having to make, and and little things can get in the way of them. And if it destroys your self-confidence, you know, you don't want to imitate Chandler to the point where you're drinking too much.
Right. Right. Everyone's got their own process.
Can't get any word to count without any Jack Daniels. Let me ask you, Kelly Stanley, what was tougher, getting a master's degree in classics or writing Nox Dormienda, A Long Night for Sleeping?
Well, I would say the master's degree was tougher, and because I had to write a thesis to go with that, and the thesis dealt with some rather esoteric topics dealing with Orphic cult in Euripides Bacchae, and it had a lot of ancient Greek in it, and it was tough. Greek is not my forte. I was much more of a Latin person, and I was actually a Romanist, but for some reason I chose that as my thesis topic. And it was tough. It was hard to get through. I enjoyed it, but writing is something that you do because you love, and writers like yourself and Panny, you know, you do it because you have to do it. It's part of who you are. So it didn't really feel like it was hard work to get the writing done. Revising is a different story. Revising can be a little bit harder.
Yes.
Getting an agent is at least as hard, if not harder, than getting published. So,
that for you? Was it something that happened instantaneously? Like, I've heard some stories, like, people get, they write their book and all of a sudden the agent appears, and it's like, wow, how the
hell? Yeah, I wish. I actually felt like I was really lucky for a brief moment, because the first agent I queried signed me to a contract, and she had a very good reputation. She's a lovely person. It just didn't work out. And she did some things that were not terrific for me, and she wound up moving out of the country. Okay. And it sort of left me in a situation that wasn't so great. But then, because of the connections that I had made at that point and had already secured a publishing contract on my own, I was able to get with a very good agency. It's actually Glenda Burgess's same agency. Although she doesn't have the same agent that I do, it's the same agency. So they're a terrific, terrific literary agency. And they add William Faulkner and Henry Miller among their clients. So I'm very, very happy to be there. So, you know, there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And I guess the rule of that story, or the lesson to be learned, is that even if you think that you've got it made because you've got an agent and you got one quickly, it's not always going to work out. Agents are people, too, and they're going to take paths that, you know, you may not be able to predict from their record. You never know what's going to happen. So you just have to keep going.
Oh, boy, isn't that the truth? When I got my agent in 1989, he had his office on West End Avenue. The first thing that he did is he stopped going into his office and handled everything from his home in the Hamptons. The next thing he did is he cut out all adult books and decided he would only sell YA literature. Then he cut that out and retired. And he said to me, "I'm getting out of this business. It just isn't the same business that it used to be when I started." And I said to myself, "Well, that's the way the cookie crumbles." Boy, we've had a great time with Kelly Stanley. The book is Nox Dormienda, A Long Night for Sleeping, an Arcturus Mystery. Give us your contact information quickly, as we have our goddess Chanteuse, Claudine Longe.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Panny. It was an absolute pleasure. My website is the best place to find Latin translations and information on the book. It's www.kellystanley.com. And thank you again for hosting me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Kelly. We'll have you on many times. Panny, tell the audience about your show this week.
We are having Danny Ladoni, who is the filmmaker of the movie Playing Columbine. It's a documentary, actually, about a video game that they created, commenting on the Columbine murders. Remember those murders that happened in the high school? So it's a very, very thought-provoking, controversial documentary. It is airing and appearing at AFI Film Festival this coming week in L.A., and he's going to be on the show to talk a little bit more about that. So I'm excited. Next Wednesday at 6.
Excellent. Thank you, ladies. You made Goddess Radio the freshest breath of air on the ether waves. Stay tuned for Midnight Bookworm, Books and Entertainment with my fabulous co-host, the one and only Uber Las Vegas agent. I almost said Los Angeles.